Okay, if you're new here, I'm Joel. I'm one of the leaders in the church, and we have teaching from the Bible every week. We have been for a while now in the book of Nehemiah. It's, I guess, about a third of the way through the Bible, and we're in chapter 11 today. It's a long chapter. I'll actually read bits of it. Some of it is lists of names, and we make a point sometimes of reading them, but other times, for the sake of time, we can skip a few, but I want to read some of the key verses to give you an idea of what's going on in this part of the Bible. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring one out of ten to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while nine out of ten remained in other towns. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. These are the chiefs of the province who lived in Jerusalem. But in the towns of Judah, everyone lived on his property in their towns. Israel, the priests, the Levites, the temple servants, and the descendants of Solomon's servants. And in Jerusalem lived certain of the sons of Judah and of the sons of Benjamin. Now I'm going to skip down to verse 19. The gatekeepers, Akkub, Talmon, and their brothers, who kept watch at the gates, were 172. And the rest of Israel and of the priests and the Levites were in all the towns of Judah, everyone in his inheritance. But the temple servants lived in Ophel, and Zichar and Gishba were over the temple servants. Verse 22, the overseer of the Levites in Jerusalem was Uzzi, the son of Bani, son of Hashabiah, son of Mattaniah, son of Micah, of the sons of Asaph, the singers over the work of the house of God. For there was a command from the king concerning them, and a fixed provision for the singers, as every day required. And Pethahiah, the son of Meshezabel, of the sons of Zerah, the son of Judah, was at the king's side in all matters concerning the people. Some people refer to the story the Bible tells as a tale of two cities. And you can see it that way. That's one way to understand it. The story of the city of this world and the city of God. City of this world, on the one hand, that's humankind's society, culture, communities, human life without God, without reference to God. Sometimes the Bible refers to the city of this world as Babylon. Okay, that was actually a place. You can go there now where it would have been built, but it's really a code word as well for all of the structures of society, all of the civilization that man builds independently of God. And then on the other side, you have the story of the city of God, God's alternative city, God's plan to build his community, his society through history. And that's a theme that comes all the way through the pages of the Bible. In fact, what happens in the Old Testament is one specific city, Jerusalem in Israel, becomes really the kind of focus of all of the hopes for the world, for the future of the world. It becomes seen as God's city, God's capital city on planet Earth. And you can see as we read just now in verse 1 even, it talks about Jerusalem, the holy city. It's not just any city, it's the holy city, it's God's city, sometimes called Zion, that's the word. God's city, God's dwelling place, God's amazing place. It's amazing because it's where God has decided to identify himself with. It's kind of, it says it's a city for my name. In other words, his reputation kind of stands or falls according to Zion. And it's a place for justice. It talks in the Psalms, the great hymn book of the Bible, about a king who will reign from Zion and bring justice to the nations. He'll set forth his scepter and see that justice and righteousness is done because he's the great king of Zion. And then also it's a place from which God's righteous law is made known. So you get places like in Micah chapter 4, Isaiah chapter 2, which say the law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, to judge between nations and settle disputes and bring an end to bloodshed and war. Zion, Jerusalem, God's city, has got an amazing destiny. It's the place that's destined to bring in the goodness and the blessing and the peace and the mercy and the justice of God to the world. And then you start reading and you think, how can that all come from one kind of town in the Middle East? Surely that doesn't work. It doesn't fit into one place. And then when you get to the New Testament, Jesus, he actually uses the Zion idea. He takes the concept of the city of God. And in Matthew chapter 5, he refers to his people this way. So let's just look at the screen. You are the light of the world. He's talking here to not the people of Jerusalem necessarily. Some of them might have come from there, but some of them came from all over the place. He says, you, what's the you? It's Jesus' people, Jesus' followers. If you're a follower of Jesus here, this is about you. He says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. What's he saying? He's saying, right, okay, all the things that you've heard said about the city, Zion, Jerusalem, God's city, I want you to see that as you now. That's who you are. What, us? Yeah, you. Why? What's special about us? What, we don't the first thing about town planning and local government, and what's the deal? He said, no, you are my people. That's the deal. That's it. You're my people. You're the people of God. That's it. You're the city of God. And then you keep reading, and you get to the very end of the Bible, literally the last page. It describes the ultimate destiny of the city. It talks about this new Jerusalem coming down from heaven like a bride prepared for the groom, like a radiant, spotless bride. This is an awesome theme. You read the Bible, you get the understanding that God's plan all through history, from before the beginning of time, God's plan has been to have a people who are devoted to him in that beautiful, faithful, pure way that a bride is devoted to her groom on her wedding day. Given over to him together to say, we are your people. We shine for you. We're radiant for you. The bride of Christ, the city of God. And you might say, well, where is it then? Where is the city of God? Well, look around you. It's his people. And it means that his city spreads globally. It doesn't get located anymore in one place. It's wherever. Jesus said to a lady in John chapter 4, the time's coming, has now come, when God's people will worship him, not in this mountain or that mountain, but in spirit and in truth. Anywhere where people know Jesus by the Holy Spirit, where they know him in their hearts because God's woken them up inside. So you might think today, I've come to church because I've heard a little bit about this church. I'd like to know what Christianity is. Presumably it means you have to do certain things and behave a certain way and perform certain rituals and keep certain rules. The truth is, no, it's not really about stuff that you do. It's something that happens to you. It's something that happens on the inside of you. It's like you wake up, a light goes on. You see properly for the first time. And Jesus is saying to this lady in John chapter 4, those who worship him will worship him in spirit and in truth. There's a revelation. It's something they just suddenly understand. God's real. He has a son, Jesus, and I live for him. He's the one I was made for. And when that happens to you, you have become part of the city of God, wherever you live, whether you live in Jerusalem or whether you live, I don't know, in Ditchling or Timbuktu or Buenos Aires or Paris or wherever. You're the city. You're part of the city. Now, the thing that you notice as well as you read through the book, you get to places where the churches start to get established, that the followers of Jesus begin new churches, new outposts, if you like, of the city. New little pieces of the city get placed in different places. What you'll notice is that they tend to go to the cities, the existing cities, the cities of this world. It's like they deliberately choose to set up little mini cities of God within the cities of man. It's like kind of putting cuckoo's eggs in the nest. You know, so they're kind of saying, we're going to put in right in here, in Ephesus or Corinth or Rome. These are all famous ancient cities of the time. We're going to plant a little Jesus colony in this city so that when people see the people of the church, they see a version of themselves, but different because they've got Jesus in the middle of their lives. They're building their lives not on the principles of this city, this passing city of man that chases after money and sex and power for all the wrong reasons, but we are basing our lives on Jesus, on Him and Him alone. And because of that, we look the same on the outside. Maybe we look just the same as everyone else in the city. But within, and as people get to know us properly and see our community, see the way we love one another, see the way we conduct our lives and our behavior, they see a version of themselves which could be if only they turn their lives over to God. They'll see when they look at the church, they'll see, well, these people are just like us, but they've got something else. They know God. I want to know that God as well. They deliberately targeted the key cities in which to plant these churches. And there's lots of reasons for that, but when you think about it, it's kind of one of the obvious ones is that if you reach the key cities, you kind of reach the whole world. And that's still basically the case. There are certain cities that have influence. They're like amplifiers for the message of the gospel. If you plug Jesus into some cities, it goes out. It makes a bigger noise. That's not saying that Jesus doesn't care about the rural areas as well, but if you put a church in the middle of a city like Brighton, chances are it will get known about. The gospel of Jesus will spread out. It will fan out from there. And that's why, for example, we've deliberately said to ourselves and in our hearts and prayed about putting churches in Berlin, for example. So this city here, one of my favorite places in the world now, having been there a few times, we have two very small little Jesus colonies in Berlin. Two that are saying to us, we're looking to your oversight. We're busy trying to get these two church plants growing in that mighty city, many millions. But I tell you, Berlin is one of the most incredible places in the world, one of the most important cities in the Northern Hemisphere. It is a privilege to have people right there building Jesus community in the heart of that buzzing city, that pumping, thriving place. Because we know if we reach that place, we will reach way beyond it as well. It will just fan out. It will just go out from there and all across it and all around it. And think of all the things about Berlin that make Berlin, Berlin. All the, just the music and the digital industries and the creativity and the industry and the commerce, all kinds of stuff, the education institutions, loads of stuff that happens there that if you put Jesus right in the heart of it, it will have huge impact on society. So we deliberately target such places. It's the same with Amsterdam. Amsterdam is just a tiny, short little flight away in one of the countries most close to us. And this year, Matt and Joe Simmons, who lead the Shoreham 9 o'clock service, they're flying with their four daughters to the heart of this beast of a city. And Amsterdam is an amazing place. And that's where we as a church have the privilege of pitching up a flag saying, We want to stamp something in the ground here for Jesus. We want to plant a new community. We want to put the city of God within the city of this world. We want to put it there in the face of the world. We want to show off to the world, in the right sense, how good Jesus is, how different He makes your life, how much He transforms your heart and your community and your family and your marriage and what He does to life to make it purposeful and eternally meaningful. People will hear the message of the gospel through sermons and they'll read it in the Bible. When they see it in a community, it has tremendous impact. So we plant churches in these vital places deliberately. Here's the thing to watch out for, and you need to hear this. Everybody, right? You're watching this on the video in Villas or Shoreham or the racecourse or listening to me here. There's a massive danger right now while I'm saying all this, because what you could do is think, okay, therefore I get what you're saying, We are sending missionaries to those cities because they're that's the mission field out there. You showed us some pictures, Berlin, Amsterdam, that's presumably the mission field. Good for them. Good for those diehard, upstanding, impressive, expert Christians, the hardcore Christians. Well done, those people. Well done, Matt and Joe Simmons. Well done, Neville and Sue Jones, who are in Berlin at the moment. Well done. That's excellent for you. You're on mission while I'm in Brighton. And, it's nice to send you. Here we are in our more established church. I just want to help you by killing that idea. by running it through with a big blade. It's wrong. Because you listen, you've got to hear me. You are on mission in this city of Brighton just as much as they are. Just as much as anyone in the world is. We do have this tendency to separate certain Christians because of certain trappings. You know, in recent generations, it has been missionaries. You know, these are the hardcore Christians. They go off to deep, dark countries to tell people about Jesus and hopefully not get eaten. That's a real Christian. Wow, hardcore Christians, they're missionaries. You know, a few generations before that, it was the monks. Monks were the real, you know, we're all kind of Christians, but I'm not a monk. I mean, monks are amazing. Monks are flipping rocket. They don't even get married. They're not allowed to. Nuns and monks not allowed to get married. Imagine that. That's hardcore. They eat vegetables all the time. They do weird things with their hair and wear brown all the time. That is hardcore Christianity. And I'm just a plumber or a builder or a farmer or a full-time mum. I'm not a Christian in the hardcore sense. I'm a kind of primary school Christian. They're like PhD. And you can get into this weird stratification that is completely not biblical. It's not even, it doesn't get near. Now you can see it a little bit in this passage I read, but this isn't the community Jesus. You see here, they draw lots. And every 10th guy has to go into the city of Jerusalem to help start the new community. It's like every 10th guy, okay. That's the specialist thing, creeping into this community here in Nehemiah. But listen, Jesus, when he spoke to his city, did you notice when he's speaking to thousands of people on the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, did you notice he's talking to them all? He says, you are the light of the world. Let your light shine before men. He doesn't say, disciples, Peter, Matthew, Andrew, James, Simon the Zealot, Thaddeus, Judas, not so sure, but Philip, Thomas, all these others. You are the light of the world. I don't know who the other plebs are, but you are the light of the world. Jesus says it to everyone, all the people who love him. You are the light of the world. You are the city set on a hill. Let your light shine before men. If you're a Christian, you're a missionary. If you met Jesus, you met a missionary. And when you meet Jesus, he's got a one-track mind. He recruits you and says, great, I'm so glad to have rescued you. Now I want you to help me rescue some others. If the Father sent me, I'm sending you. We're going on mission, me and you. That's what Jesus says. That's his plan for your life, his wonderful plan for your life. You thought his plan for your life was 100 grand salary and a big car and a smoking wife. Jesus' plan for your wife is mission. That's his plan. And you think, well, I'm not going to Berlin. Maybe not. But you're going to work tomorrow. You're going to university tomorrow. You're going to the office tomorrow. You're going into your family. You're going into your halls of residence. You're going to your flat that you share with other people. You're going into Brighton tomorrow, or Shoreham, or East Brighton, or Hove. You're going into the city as God's city. You're going on mission. It's who you are now. As much as these brave, intrepid first few people into the new walls of Jerusalem. We're going into this new place. We've just stepped the walls up. Feels a little bit small, feels a little bit rickety, but we trust that there's some purpose to it. It's so easy, guys, to think we don't need to bother in Brighton. We've got it lit. We've got a building, for goodness sake. You know, I thought that. I grew up in this church. I planted this church in 1979. When I was 4 years old, my dad thought he planted it, but I was actually making all the decisions and leading it from my master, my pram, my evil lair, the pushchair. So I planted this church in 1979 and then moved away, and then God surprised me. I thought I was going to go overseas because that's where mission happens. I had a plan. We'd announced it. We'd planned it. My wife and I were expecting to go over to Johannesburg. And then God surprised me, shocked me, 2005, and spoke to us about coming back to Brighton. I thought, why? Why would I? What's the point? Brighton's been reached, right? It's a church of hundreds of people in Brighton. Hundreds of people. I mean, maybe with a few other good churches in the city, thousands, or a few thousand Christians. Maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, maybe a good Sunday. Maybe 7, 8,000 Christians in church in Brighton and Hove area on a good Sunday. On a really good Sunday. That's pathetic. It's tragic. It's awful. I mean, I'm using silly words for something that's actually very serious. The whole conurbation, if you include every satellite town, about 500,000, if you really think about it. 500,000. A few thousand that might know Jesus. I thought, well, we've got Brighton Suss, we've got a big church there. No, we haven't. I want you to see, we haven't, guys, we haven't started. The guys in maybe in Shoreham, they know this, all right? The guys starting at 4 o'clock at the Villas, they know this. The guys starting at 7 o'clock in Shoreham. The guys at the race course, the guys, they know, okay, this feels new. I think us in New England don't get it. But I'd really like the whole church to get it. We need to get this. We are on mission. We're just as on mission as these 10% that go into the Jerusalem city and say, okay, we'll start. And it's a huge challenge. It's a huge risk. It's very difficult to be the city of God within the city of man. Wow. Oh, man, it's difficult. Let's be honest. It's difficult for a few reasons. Let me give you three really quickly. First of all, it's difficult because we are impatient, right? We're just impatient by nature. We want things to go well now. We want success now. We want to feel like our team is winning for once, that we're getting through to the Premiership, for example. We want progress quick. We want to see it. We want to look at charts and bar charts and lines, and we want to see progress. And if we don't see it, well, I'm quitting. Tired of this. I only like being involved in things that grow fast and have impact quick and look impressive and sexy and big and powerful in the eyes of the world. It's what we want, isn't it? And then we rock up to a meeting and half the people haven't turned up, and the ones that have turned up are the wrong ones. And the room is messy and the chairs aren't set out properly and the screen doesn't work and the guitar strings snap, and you think, what is this about? What is this stupid church for? I'm going to go and watch TV. What are we doing in this situation? Because we want instant results that make us feel gratified and important and impressive. And these guys, they're just turning up in this ghost town, Jerusalem. There's no one really been living there. It hasn't looked good for a long time. Got overran by the Babylonians, got smashed to bits. They're brave. They're brave. So we're going to start again. Just the first few people. They must have had in their heart this deep confidence. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Maybe not quickly. Maybe not even in our lifetimes. But it's going to be great. I mean, this church started with about 40 people. As I said when I started it. It's just a few families, just a few crazy families saying, let's start a church, let's build, let's commit to each other, let's go for it. And now, maybe on a good Sunday, 1,200, 1,300 people. And you think about Berlin, you guys think about Shoreham, you think about the Villas, you think about the race course, you think, oh, it just feels small, it feels small, it feels small, it feels like we're starting, it feels small at New England, I'll be honest with you. Quite often on a Sunday, I'm thinking, okay, we need to fatten things up here, we've sent a lot of people out, we need to grow again. And it can be tempting to get very impatient. I feel this. I kind of hope you do as well, otherwise I worry about you. But we have to learn how to process our impatience. Understand that you can be about a very great work, even if it feels small at the start. You know, the Pilgrim Fathers who sailed over to America from Plymouth in the 1620s. It's only about 100 people, 120 adults. And they were starting the nation that's now 300 million, considered the great nation of America. They were just starting it. Just something that looks so humble, so brave, intrepid, just a little community on a boat. That's how great things begin usually, by not looking great, but having a great, great vision. That's what these people are like here. That's what I want to be like. That's what you should be like. Otherwise, what are you living for anyway? What are you doing with your life if you're not giving it to something great? What a waste of your life. What a stupid waste of life. Build the church. Give yourself to the church. It's the only thing that will last forever on planet Earth. I know what to give my time to. I'm not an idiot. I used to be, but Jesus saved me. Don't waste your life. Build the church. So don't be impatient about it. And then the second problem we have is our insularity. You feel outnumbered. You feel like it's only us. We stand out a bit. We're a bit awkward. We follow Jesus. No one even believes in Jesus around here in Brighton. Jesus isn't like everyone's favorite homeboy. It's like Jesus is kind of awkward, embarrassing. You don't say his name at parties. It's just a little bit weird. I love Jesus. And even that sounds a bit cheesy. I love Jesus. So what do I do? Maybe we just kind of just get into a huddle. We just stay with our own kind. We hang out with Christians all the time. And we pretend that we're changing the city, when actually we're just having Christian meetings. It's insularity. You can get away with that. You can, trust me. I'm good at that. I'm good at great meetings. It's good, it's important, but it's not the same thing as what I'm talking about. It's not the same thing. Jesus wants a city in the city. He doesn't want his people out of the world. He prayed in John 17, I do not want you, Father, to take them out of the world. I want them to be in the world. I want them to be in the world's face. I want the world to see me through them. How are that going to happen if they are in ghettos, in holy huddles, having amazing meetings that no non-Christians can come to? That no non-Christians would go near. How can it happen if they don't have any connections and friendships and ability to have any real social engagement with the world around them? Jesus wants people on mission. That means that we engage. We cannot do the insularity thing. It's tempting, but it's unacceptable. It's a huge, huge challenge for us to work through. It's a bit like, you know, when people used to try and blow up huge rock boulders when they were going building rail tracks, railroads or railways. In the 19th century, they get to big hills and they think, how do we get through this? If we want to get a flat bit of land to put the railway through here, we need to blow it up. We need to stick some dynamite on it. And so with dynamite, what you do is you have a choice. You can either stick the dynamite on the edge of the boulder and blow it up. But what do you think happens then? Not much. Just shards of little bits of rock fly off. But the explosion hasn't moved the rock. It's just made a bit of noise. The alternative is you tunnel into the rock. You get into it. You stick the dynamite right in the heart of the rock. And then you detonate it from the outside. And the rock is blown away. That's what mission should be like. See, Christians, what we tend to do is one or the other. We have amazingly explosive Christianity, but we have it on the side of the rock. So nothing really changes. You have churches that look amazing, and Brighton stays the same. Or we say, no, we're going to tunnel in. We're going to get stuck right into the city. We're going to go right in, wade into culture, get to know people, get to know society. But what we can sometimes do when we do that is lose the dynamite. We tunnel in, but we don't explode. We don't shine. We're not different. And that's the third danger. If the second danger is insularity, the third danger is assimilation. Where we just assimilate, we just follow the world in its ways because we want the world to like us, to accept us, and we don't want to be any different. So we water down this book, we change the verses that we know that they won't like. Oh, they won't like it if we say that. They won't like it if we preach. They won't like it if we talk about sin and heaven and hell and the blood of Jesus and God being angry with sin and God having passionate concerns about how we use sexuality and what it's for and families and what they're for. And that's really, really awkward. So let's just pretend that isn't in the book. Let's not ever, man. Let's never go near that. Let's never talk to anyone. Let's never challenge anyone. Let's never try and change anyone's life by the gospel. Let's basically water the message down. If we do that, we're assimilating. We kind of become the rock. We tunnel in. And we become the rock. Jesus says, be in the world, but not of it. Be like aliens and strangers. Be different, though you're in it. In it, truly in it, connecting with it, answering its questions, speaking its language, knowing its ways, understanding the culture, understanding the city. We want to spend time knowing Brighton, knowing Berlin, knowing Amsterdam, wherever else Jesus sends us. We want to understand so we can talk to it. Jesus became a man, became flesh. God became the people he was called to reach. God, he decided to become a man so that he could reach men, so that he could find them and seek them and rescue them. We must become Brightonians, become Amsterdam and Berliners. We must learn to find our way into the world in order to offer them Christ, the sweetness of the gospel that they so desperately need. So we can't assimilate. And we mustn't disintegrate, which I would see as a sort of soft version of assimilation. That's when you don't necessarily remove the Bible. You still say, well, I love Jesus and I still love the Bible, but I won't go to church. I don't want to go to church because church has disappointed me. Church has let me down. Church has hurt me. I could tell you stories of how the church has done me bad. I love Jesus. And I love him. I want to be a friend to non-Christians. I love sinners. I love Jesus. I want to be a missionary. I just don't want to do it with the church because the church sucks. Church annoys me. I tell you, there are probably as many people who would put themselves in that category on a Sunday in Brighton as there are people who are in church on a Sunday in Brighton. Thousands of people in this city, I reckon, who would say, yeah, I love Jesus. I just don't get the church. That's a huge thing. It's a major challenge, major problem. What are we going to do about that? I mean, the real issue there is that we've kind of decided that because something has stopped meeting my personal needs, because something has the experience ran out, the feel, the vibe. That just the sense of buzz that I had. You know, you can go into a church and feel the euphoria. You feel like this is pumping. These people are, I love being around these. And there are seasons, you can go through a season in church life where it feels like that, heavily like that. And if you join at one of those times especially, you're on a ride. It's very exciting. But the church is like all institutions, all organizations, like all families, frankly. I know families. You know, I grew up in a family of five kids. I now have a family of five kids. I know what families are like. They have ups and downs, seasons, dry times, exciting times, fast times, slow times. Times when you feel king of the world, when everybody likes you, everyone knows your name, all your friends sit in the same area every Sunday. You really know your small group. You're really tight with them. You feel accepted, encouraged, received when you do your thing, whether it's on a platform or in a living room or in the office or whatever, on the website. The thing you do, everyone stops and says, thanks so much for the thing you do. Love your gift. We love your style. We love your contribution. We really like you. The thing is, during those times, you tend to think that you personally are growing. You're spiritually growing. That's when you're getting big spiritually. The actual truth is probably the reverse. Probably when you're caught up in the feel-good factor, you are not growing that much. I won't say you're not growing at all, because who am I to say that? I don't know. But when I read this book, I notice the way God tends to grow people, and there's very little feel-good factor. The way God really develops strong pillars in the church, men and women who take punches, who push through, who persevere, who build cities, who stay in Jerusalem and make it a great city again. Those people go through months, years, maybe decades, where no one encourages them, no one thanks them, no one barely recognizes them. They walk through strong times, tough times, where the tide is against them, where no one sometimes even understands what they're feeling, how sad they are that the church isn't what it used to be, that it's not how I like it, and my favorite experience hasn't happened for a while, and my favorite song hasn't been played for months. And my kind of meeting just doesn't seem to be the way we do meetings here. And we walk through it, and we think, is this, oh man, this doesn't meet my needs. I'm not having an experience here. It therefore cannot be right. I want to ask you, where did you get that logic from? Have you read this book? Have you noticed that God calls us to faithfulness? To faithful seasons of obedience, long, long seasons of obedience in the same direction. Where you say, I just know it's not about me. That's all I know. Jesus says, love one another. Do you notice he said it a few times? In fact, sometimes he said it a couple of times in the same paragraph. Love one another. And a new command I give to you. Love one another. Okay, sounds like a record scratching. Just okay, fine. He's making a point, perhaps, possibly, do you think? He's not saying love one another if the meetings suit you. Love one another if you feel like it. Love one another if you get a chance, if you're in the room when the decision is made, then you can love one another. If you got consulted on that change in strategy, then you can love one another. No, it just doesn't ever say it that way. It always just says love one another. I find this so hard, do you? Be honest with you. Be honest with me. I find this really hard. I find it hard because I know what it's like to go through a season when you think the organization is yours. It's not. I'm not talking about this church. I'm talking about other things that I've been through in life. You think this is mine. I'm so at home. This is like family. And then you go through a time where you realize it just isn't yours. In fact, it never really was. You just had this illusion. It used to be yours. You know, I joked about, you know, when I started this church when I was in the pram. You can have this idea, can't you? This is all about me, really. When you notice, you begin to see that it's like people are carrying on as if I don't matter. They're not asking me, what is it? What about me? What about my preferences? I recently went through this in a big way on something, and a friend of mine I was on the phone with just recently was brave enough, wise enough, gracious enough to say to me, just be careful. You might be getting a bit bitter. Just remember, it's not about any of us, is it? Be patient. Be humble. I thank God for my friend. It wasn't pleasant at the time to hear it, but he was so right. Rescued me, I hope. I hope he has. I'm still praying about it. But I tell you, if you hang around church enough, you will go through that. I predict it because it's human. I don't have to be a prophet. You will go through it. You'll have to face it after it. Okay, it's not about me. I follow. I trust. I know that God wants me here. I'll be faithful. I'm building a great city. It's not about me. It's a glorious city. And I won't allow it to disintegrate because it didn't meet my needs for a stretch. Maybe for a while, maybe for a few months. You know, it's like that. If you've got a great project going, it will take time. I've had projects where I've thought, when is this going to come to an end? You ever had builders in the house? You know, the idea of, you know, okay, I know that you're building my kitchen, but where is the kitchen I'm supposed to use now? Well, it's kind of that square foot you're standing in. That's your kitchen right now. You know, if you had a bathroom done. So where do I go? Find somewhere, because we're doing this right now. And you just have to go through the season. How long is it going to be like this? As long as it takes. And God's much worse than builders are at giving an accurate date. You know, builders, they get it wrong, but at least they give you a date. God doesn't do that. He doesn't say, oh, this trial will last 3 months. Never says that. He just says, trust me and be quiet. Am I not a good God? Don't you have good reason to trust me? Don't you know that I'm for you? Don't you know that my plans for your life are way better than your silly ones? Way better than your dream of how the church is all about you. You have a God in heaven, a Father in heaven who's all about you. Who needs the church to be all about them when they have a Father who can't stop thinking about them, who bores everyone at parties with pictures of you on his iPhone? This is my kid. Have you seen my kid? That's what he's like with you. If you know Jesus, he cannot get over you. Why would you be so concerned that other people build you up all the time?